Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. COVID-19 has upended life for everyone. If you're also struggling to translate from a foreign language, the constant stream of information about the pandemic, the struggle takes on a different set of concerns. For the more than 155,000 Columbus residents who hail from foreign countries, from Mexico to Somalia, the hurdle of the coronavirus exacerbates the challenges of employment, unemployment, education, and mental health, and much more. Angela Plummer is the executive director of the Community Refugee and Immigration Services, otherwise known as CRIS, right here in Columbus. Welcome back to the show, Angie.
Thank you, Ann.
Is there a way to summarize? I mean, what are you hearing from where you sit about the circumstances of the folks you serve at CRIS?
Well, refugees and immigrants are experiencing the hardships that are, you know, similar to what the general population, but there are some unique aspects to it. Certainly, a lot of immigrant families are multi-generational, and so you have young children living with, you know, elderly people. I think my mom is listening. So hi, mom. we're able to put mom in her house, and she's able to be safely there, quarantined, you know, stir crazy. But a lot of families aren't able to do that. And when you live in a, you know, small apartment with all these people, it's really much harder to do the kind of precautions that are needed. Certainly, internet and Wi-Fi access have been a challenge. Lots of need for assistance with unemployment applications. And I want anything I say not to be taken as criticism, but just as an observation on what's out there. But we've helped probably 90 people apply for unemployment. A handful have cash in hand. Many people aren't going to be eligible for state unemployment and are waiting for the federal program to kick in. I know the folks at unemployment are doing their level best, waiting for the federal system to get up and running. But meanwhile, people need to eat and have resources to pay for rent. So that's been a challenge. I know we'll hear more from Columbus City Schools about, you know, the unique challenges it's presented to them to have to do this remote learning when there are families that have little English spoken by a parent and pretty hard to figure out how to navigate the instructional plans, get the internet set up. So that brings its own, you know, set of unique challenges.
You know, actually, this program was inspired by a gentleman who I think it called in last week. And I can't remember where he's from originally, but he said he has, I think it was 6 or 8 kids and struggling to get the lessons done properly and do all of the things you just described, get the internet set up properly, get the lessons plans going. And the in English is his second language, and he's just learning it himself.
Yeah, we have one of the kids in our mentorship program had commented about he has to share one computer with 2 siblings, and they rotate when they sleep so they can divide up the time on the computer. Mm. And, you know, they've left behind all kinds of social supports, you know, whether it was the library program after school that helped with homework or just being around their friends, you know, and getting away from being in a cramped house with a lot of people. So it's a lot of coping that's going on right now. And certainly it's been a challenge trying to get the message out there into the community in other languages. There are efforts underway to come up with sort of a centralized plan for how to really rapidly get that information out there. But we saw some gaps in some recently arrived communities, in particular the Tigrinya-speaking community, those are Eritreans, the Kenya-Rwanda and Swahili speakers, mostly from Congo. And trying to put messages into a PSA format because, you know, many communities aren't going to read it and none of us are going around distributing flyers in writing. So we needed to get it into a format that would actually spread quickly through those communities. So we've done these PSAs in partnership with, many of you may know, Tariq Terry and Laura Berger have helped with that, trying to make it so that you know, our case manager does the video, and then we can share it through WhatsApp or Facebook or a platform where people will actually be able to see it. I have a little funny story that highlights this problem. And the governor's press briefings are available in other languages, and there was an instruction sent around about how to access them. So I thought I would try it, and I tried to navigate through the system. I was doing it on my phone, and I managed somehow to change the YouTube instructions into Tigrinya, a language I don't read, and I can't change it back. So I got stuck with this script on my phone that I can't figure out. But, and I don't know if that's a testament to my lack of technology savviness or that it's complicated to get to that point where you can actually do that. So our effort was to try to do a stopgap, like let's get these quick, you know, few minute podcasts out there, you know, so that they can quickly spread around the community. We're doing a topic on, we're doing masks this week.
The all-important masks.
Yes.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking about Central Ohio's refugee and immigrant community, how they're managing during the pandemic, given all of the obstacles they already faced as new Americans. My guest is Angela Plummer. She's executive director of the Community Refugee and Immigration Services. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. We are going to be hearing from a journalist from the Minneapolis-St. Paul area, which has the largest settlement of Somali refugees in the country. Columbus comes in second on that score, and we often look to that community and to see how they're doing. And coming up later in the program, we're going to be talking to somebody from Columbus City Schools about how they're managing with families for whom English is a second language and all the other challenges they face as immigrants and refugees in keeping their kids educated. Where is there a place that people are calling with questions?
Yes, I'm sure those are very widespread. We have certain subject matter areas that we've identified. You know, people will call Chris. We can help with unemployment applications. You know, something we saw early on was, you know, mass layoff and employees sent home with a notice from their employer and they don't speak much English. So then they have their 7-year-old help them try to fill it out online and they don't save their PIN number. And so then it ends up in our lap trying to get the PIN number back and to help people start over again. There are other, we have a senior refugee program. So a lot of things we can do remotely, you know, calling clients to check in on them, help them know what to do, how to contact their healthcare provider. But certain things still need to happen, like meals. And so for our senior refugee program, we've been doing meal drop-offs, you know, with Life Care Alliance and St. Stephen's Food Pantry. The schools, I think, have really, really pulled out all the stops trying to get everybody an email address. And I'm sure you'll talk more with the school officials later. But there are, you know, it just depends on, that was part of my challenge during the first week of all this, is to figure out, to filter through all the information. You know, COTA's bus routes were changing daily.
Yeah, it's hard enough.
You know, having somebody staying on top of the latest and the greatest. So we kind of assigned subject matter experts for different topics, whether it was the schools or unemployment or food distribution, that kind of stuff.
And, you know, this is something that kind of opened, my eyes were open to, and I guess I should have been a long time before that, but when I did the documentary with our television folks, the Columbus Neighborhoods documentary on New Americans some years ago, is the senior population. So many of them move here as very old people who don't speak the language, sometimes are not literate in any language. And there's a huge mental health issue. There's already massive isolation.
Yes. I mean, that's the reason our program exists to begin with, is to try to combat that isolation. So that's an extra challenge during the pandemic for all seniors, regardless of, you know, where they're from, but is exacerbated by those who, you know, don't speak English. And I feel blessed that we have this program that can at least serve some segment of the population.
Has there been any sense or any evidence that the COVID-19 has disproportionately infected the immigrant and refugee population in Central Ohio?
You know, I don't know that yet. I haven't seen any data that would suggest one way or the other. I know there certainly is data that confirms that African Americans are, you know, drastically impacted by the virus, and many refugees are of African descent. And so I don't know what correlation, you know, there may be, but I certainly many refugees are in essential jobs in the food security, you know, pipeline.
Mm-hmm.
And so they're on the front lines in the warehouses and in the grocery stores. And, you know, I knew quite a few working in healthcare settings as well. So that's also putting them at additional risk because they're, you know, out there doing this, you know, so necessary work. So that's also another, you know, added factor.
Is there a reluctance among them to seek medical care and or legal assistance?
I think sometimes. Some will, it'll be a challenge because their go-to would be the ER. And so that's not really an option right now.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the role of service providers to make sure they're connected to a, like a primary care doc or some kind of clinic. So that's a problem anyway. So adding the pandemic on top of it is just an additional hurdle. Legal services, you know, it's right now probably the biggest need is for employment-related legal services, people worrying about, gosh, we're all going back to work. Is it safe at my workplace? If I don't feel safe and I want to quit my job, will I lose my benefits? You know, those kinds of questions. From the immigration legal services standpoint, we pretty swiftly closed down our intake because that was the high volume area of our agency, mm-hmm. and have been able to do quite a bit remotely. There are some abilities to submit forms without signatures. We'll have to figure out a way to resume working with clients, but in a safe way. And our goal is not to be on the cutting edge of getting back to work because we have found, gosh, there are things we can do remotely that might even be beneficial. Like, well, we've been doing citizenship classes remotely. Have found curricula and doing things that, you know, for clients who have transportation barriers, that might be helpful anyway. So looking for a silver lining, you know, some of those practices are also evolving.
We're talking about the plight of refugee and immigrants in Central Ohio and beyond. My guest is Angie Plummer. She's executive director at the Community Refugee and Immigration Services here in Central Ohio. Coming up, we're going to hear from a reporter from the Minneapolis Star Tribune on the topic. Minneapolis-St. Paul is the number one settlement location for Somali Americans in the United States. Columbus is number two, but far outnumbered in the Minneapolis-St. Paul region. So we're going to talk to them about how they're managing things there, as we often do when we're on this topic. And we'll take your questions or comments. Give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. I'd particularly like to hear from new Americans about how you're managing during this pandemic. So please give us a call or email us, and stay tuned. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Dan Fisher. We're talking about how new Americans, immigrants, and refugees are coping with the COVID-19 pandemic. The U.S. admitted more than 90,000 refugees from Somalia between 2001 and 2015 alone, many more since then. Most settled in the Minneapolis-St. Paul area of Minnesota. The second largest settlement of Somali refugees is in central Ohio. Still with us is Community Refugee and Immigration Services Executive Director Angela Plummer. Maya Rao reports on race and immigration for the Minneapolis Star-Tribune. Welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
How do you describe the engagement between the Somali community there and the city at large? And if you could compare and contrast it, has it changed much during the pandemic?
Well, the Somali refugee community here has been settled here for several decades, so they're definitely a very established part of the community now. Basically, during the pandemic, there have been challenges in trying to reach out to them, but the message is getting through. There's been a lot of coordination with the city of Minneapolis and the state to make sure that translated messages are getting out and the community is following social distancing. So I think the message has been getting through over the last month or so.
And how are they doing that primarily? Is it online? Is it through the mail, television, PSAs, that kind of thing?
Well, the Minnesota Department of Health had initially started trying to translate a lot of materials online and translating flyers, but there was a recognition that some communities, including the Somali community, they're more of an oral society. Sometimes among elders, there's not as much literacy. So there's been a lot of work with trying to get out videos, trying to work with community leaders, and really do work a lot with ethnic media, too, on the radio, on TV. The city of Minneapolis also has cultural programming to try to get through to people in various mediums.
Is there much of an ethnic media situation here in central Ohio, Angie Plummer?
Yeah, there is. There's a Somali TV, Spanish-speaking programming on television. So it varies. There is some. There isn't any Nepali visual. But there, depending on the size of the community, there are some resources. That's kind of why we looked at these minority languages. But even so, there are, you know, pockets of the community that aren't getting something. And one thing I wanted to bring up to be sure I didn't forget, and this would apply anywhere, the governor talked in his press briefing about this next stage and that contact tracing will be a big, important part of it. And I can't emphasize enough how important it will be to effectively do that to make sure there's bilingual capacity or some kind of interpretation, systematic interpretation so that the communities that aren't native English speakers, that there's good communication with them. So as they're hiring these hundreds of workers, they really need to keep that in the forefront. And the governor mentioned it yesterday, but I hope that it will filter down to whoever's doing the hiring, how critical that will be, whether that's the local health departments or cities. But that's going to be essential if we're going to have effective tracing.
Has that been something on people's minds, Maya Rao, in Minneapolis, St. Paul?
Yeah, definitely. Among state leaders, there's a lot of efforts to make sure that non-English speakers are getting the message out.
What are the struggles there still? I know that it's a more settled community than it might be in Columbus, but are there still struggles that have been exacerbated, I suppose, is the question, by the pandemic, Maya?
Yeah, the struggles are kind of vary based on whether the refugees are newer versus those. A lot of the Somali community is more established, but one of the bigger things that affects them a bit more than other people is that they really are known for having a lot of really small businesses. There are Somali malls. They have a very vibrant entrepreneurial culture here, and there's just a lot of worries about how they're going to be able to ride out this pandemic. There's fears that they don't qualify for a lot of small business loans that the state is handing out. And they really have been able to form a really rich entrepreneurial community in Somali neighborhoods that people are worried, kind of where it's going to go from here.
That's the case as well in Columbus, right, Angie Plummer?
Yeah, and another thing to keep in mind is a lot of refugees work in businesses that are over 500 employees, so they're not eligible for some of the COVID relief provisions. You know, likewise, newer arrivals, this is oversimplifying it, but for the most part, those who entered this fiscal year, so beginning in October, are not eligible for the economic impact payments.
From the federal government? Is that what you mean?
That's correct, because they don't have sufficient residency time here. So the newcomers aren't going to get those payments. There are many who don't have sufficient work quarters to qualify for state unemployment benefits. They will be eligible for the federal program once it's going. And so I worry that we have an eviction issue coming. I know, you know, local courts aren't doing evictions, but that doesn't mean payments aren't owed and that they won't accumulate. And because of the timing in terms of getting assistance, I think that could be one of our next challenges that we see.
Is that something they're talking about in Minnesota, Maya Rao?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, among our refugee and immigrant population, there are higher rates of rentals versus homeownership. And there is a concern about, you know, hey, if you just suspend rent payments, they're still going to be owed in a couple months. How are people going to make this? Especially with those small businesses, they have not been getting any revenue for the last couple weeks, and you know they're not going to be getting any for a little while longer. So where is the money going to come from? So that is definitely a concern here.
And speaking from a social service agency perspective, those small businesses will have the same challenges we have with reopening, and that we'll need masks, hand sanitizer, you know, all these things that cost money and aren't necessarily easily acquired. Mm-hmm. You know, we've been very fortunate as a member of the Human Services Chamber of Franklin County that through that entity, through support from the Columbus Foundation, that there is support for our, you know, local nonprofits. But even so, you know, I'm listening to our sister agencies talk about how they ordered masks that were then confiscated. And then, you know, especially those nonprofits that are residential facilities like the Y's and the Huckleberry House, and, you know, they're on the forefront of needing that kind of protective equipment in the same way that all businesses are going to need it once, you know, we start reopening.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking about the impact of the pandemic on the immigrant and refugee community. And we're focusing a little bit right now on the Somali American community here in Columbus and St. Paul, Minnesota area, where they have the largest settlement in the country. Columbus comes in a distant second. My guest from St. Paul, Minnesota is Maya Rao, a reporter for the Minneapolis Star Tribune. And here in Columbus, Angie Plummer. She's executive director of the Community Refugee and Immigration Services. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. What about access to health care, Maya Rao, in the Twin City area? How has that been? Is there, obviously the emergency rooms aren't an option right now. Is there enough secondary?
Yeah, I mean, in the Somali community, I haven't heard of any issues with access to health care. There's more of a concern among our Latino immigrant population here about people being afraid to get medical care if they're worried it could jeopardize their immigration status or the path to citizenship.
And I read that. Why is that? Why are they worried about that?
It was just due to the Trump administration's expansion of the public charge rule, in which seeking certain types of public benefits would impair your ability to have a path to citizenship among certain circumstances. And a lot of healthcare leaders here have said, really, this doesn't apply to that many people, but there's so much fear and confusion about it that a lot of people it doesn't even apply to have just been afraid to come in.
And not for just themselves, but for their children, for their parents, and so forth.
Right, right. But with our Somali American community here, I mean, they came as refugees, and most of them are now U.S. citizens, so that has not been an issue for that particular community.
Same for the folks in Central Ohio, Angie Plummer?
I would say it's the same sort of confusion. You know, even though USCIS, Citizenship and Immigration Services, said they won't consider COVID testing or treatment as part of public charge determination, there's still fear out there. There was a lot of confusion about how public charge would work before this, before the pandemic arrived. So I think it just adds another layer of questions.
Have the U.S. travel restrictions from countries including Somalia affected the community there, Maya Rao?
Yeah, I mean, the biggest issue right now is just that refugee flights have been suspended.
Right.
So families who were expecting to be reunited soon are now seeing their relatives kind of stuck overseas in a limbo, even if they were cleared to come here.
And what does that mean, Angela Plummer, going forward? Is there going to be like a backlog? Does it mean some people will never make it? What do we know?
Well, it remains to be seen. You know, I have a family that was waiting for their now, well, I think she's four now, four-year-old that had been waiting and waiting and waiting, was finally approved, and then the pandemic hit. So she is with her maternal grandmother in Ethiopia, and they've had to return to the camp. And I think most people agree, that movement of people is not a good idea at this time, mm-hmm. but now this little girl is going back to a camp setting, so that's worrisome in and of itself. And then the problem of medical exams expiring, security clearances expiring, you know, not necessarily for a 3 or 4 year old, but we have other families that were part of a class action lawsuit that were finally approved to come as well, and now they're also stuck. So I've been thinking about how this is the first time, certainly in my life, I've been in a position of just sitting waiting for something to happen. Like so many refugees who have waited endlessly for years and years with somebody else's hands, you know, waiting for something to happen, and how this has only been, 2 months?
Yeah.
And I'm feeling impatient. I can't imagine like a Bhutanese Nepali refugee waiting 20 years for something to happen. So get a little glimpse of what that must be like.
Yeah, it definitely is. And not ever knowing, it's the not knowing when this is going to be over with, too, complicates things. Maya Rao, what about the schools there and how they're managing it? English as a second language programs are important, but they've got to be complicated by all of this.
Yeah, I mean, that's actually one of the bigger challenges for new refugees as well as for kids. Mm-hmm. You know, English classes are being put on hold. And then in terms of schools, you know, a lot of refugee families may not have a computer or internet access or parents who have the literacy to kind of help. So that's just brought on added challenges.
Yeah, how do they, I mean, what are they doing anything special to address those challenges there?
That is not an issue I've closely covered.
Uh-huh.
In terms of the school. So I have not followed that one as closely, but that is definitely on the radar because we do have, especially among the population of school-age children, there's quite a large immigrant and refugee population here.
Yeah, and what do you make of it, Angie Plummer? How are people going to bridge this gap in education when it comes to this population?
Well, I think it depends on how long this goes on. You know, mm-hmm. what does it look like into the fall? I know they're trying, but it's just some complications that are hard to resolve, like families that don't have transportation to the parking lot where they can sit and use the Wi-Fi. You know, there's just some real hurdles and barriers for certain, especially newcomers who don't yet drive, perhaps, and don't have an adult who speaks English in the household.
Well, the libraries used to be a huge resource, and they're all closed, too, now. It's kind of hard to even imagine that the libraries are all closed, but it makes a huge impact on some people. I wanted to go back, before I let you go, Maya Rao, to the issue of businesses and You know, you said that the Somali American community there is known for small businesses, it's entrepreneurial or entrepreneurship there. Why aren't they? You said something about that they're worried that they're not going to qualify for the small business loans, or they haven't been qualifying for them. Why not?
Well, like the state had initiated some programs that would help, but they were really, a lot of them were for businesses like restaurants and theaters that were directly affected by our state shutdown. So there's a lot of others that just don't fit into that business type. They often may not be able to put up the required collateral. They don't have financial records, or they just haven't been operating long enough to demonstrate financial viability. But I mean, these are all, you know, micro businesses, sometimes mm-hmm. just one or two people. They just don't have many resources and don't fit into that conventional system.
And Angie here in Columbus?
Well, having done a payroll protection program application myself, it's not the simplest process. And I think we all know the money ran out early, and there, you know, certainly efforts underway to replenish it. But I would assume it's the same for the business community here. You know, it can be challenging, like to gather the payroll records and all that kind of stuff.
Well, speaking as a bureau phobe, I can't imagine. So, Maya Rao, thank you for your time today. I really appreciate it.
Thanks so much for having me.
Maya Rao is a reporter for the Minneapolis Star Tribune. They're in the Twin Cities, Minneapolis, St. Paul. They have the largest Somali American population in the country. Columbus is second, but a distant second on that score. We are going to now talk to Columbus City Schools about how they're managing the challenges of COVID-19 with students for whom English is a second language, or for whom, you know, or their parents for whom English is a second language, and talk about how they're managing all of that. So stay with us. If you have a question or comment, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. We're talking about Central Ohio's immigrant and refugee populations and how they're coping during the pandemic. Still with us is Community Refugee and Immigration Services Executive Director Angela Plummer. Michael Sain is the Director of the English Second Language Support Services for Columbus City Schools. Welcome to the program. Hello, Michael.
Yes.
Welcome to the program.
Thank you.
How many students are we talking about here right now for Columbus City Schools?
We are talking roughly 8,300 students at Columbus City Schools, EL students.
Are they spread across the district, or are they concentrated at all?
Yeah, they're spread across the district. Of course, in all quadrants of the city, north side, west side, south, and east side, all
so
quadrants.
That complicates things, right?
Yes, it does, but as for support that we can provide, we have, of course, schools in each of those quadrants that have what we call our EFL units in there, where they have EFL support for those students in each one of those quadrants. So we kind of spread our support out over those four quadrants where those students are located.
How many languages are first languages that we're talking about?
Yes, we roughly have about 101 different languages spoken in Columbus City Schools.
Obviously Spanish, and largely African?
Yes. Now, of those roughly 8,300 students, we have, it goes Spanish, Somali, Nepali, Arabic, and French. Those are our top five languages spoken in the district.
Huh. What has been the game plan when they said the schools are going to shut down? What wheel started turning in your mind?
Well, the main thing is that our communication with the parents and the students, especially our newcomer students, of course, students that have been, of course, in Columbus City Schools for some time, they're pretty much settled. They're versed in a lot of things that go on educational-wise when it comes to technology and whatnot, so we could stay in contact with, you know, of course, communicate with them. But the minute this happened, our concern, of course, turns to the families that are newcomers, truly newcomers that have just arrived, the parents and the students, which, of course, the language acquisition piece is huge. So that was our concern, is to make sure that we are able to communicate with those families that the language acquisition pieces are really, really lacking, and they are just in the process of learning English. So,
and of those 8,300, about how many of that is that? I mean, just generally in any given day.
Well, yeah, what we do is that it fluctuates because, of course, we have these students that come in throughout the year. So when we say true newcomers to Columbus City Schools, we're running anywhere from 250 to 300 of those students that come in annually. Now, that number can fluctuate, I mean, because, of course, they come in throughout the year. But roughly in any one year, on average, you're talking maybe 250 to 300 of those students that come into Columbus City Schools that are brand new to the area.
Now, I mentioned earlier in the program that last week a Somali American gentleman called in and said that he was really struggling. He had 8 kids at home, and managing the lesson plans for them and everything was just almost beyond him. He was overwhelmed, and who wouldn't be with 8 kids alone, let alone teaching them at home? I that's what we have teachers for. A lot of people are finding out. So what about the emotional piece of this and supporting people?
Yeah, what we do is that our teachers are excellent. You know, they've all, that our ESL teachers, and of course, all of our teachers are excellent with the Columbus City Schools, in my opinion. But what we do is that we reach out, we use our ESL teachers, of course, and our instructional assistants that have been trained in the area to reach out to those newcomer families that would need that support. Of course, not quite understanding how to get through a situation where they have the students that 5 or 6 students, family members in the classroom, or at home, and then the parent is struggling to provide that support to those students. So we try to focus on those families when they do need support. They call in, and we use our teachers, of course, that have been trained have the TESOL endorsement, and then we also use our instructional assistants. We have about 80 instructional assistants throughout the languages that can reach out to us. And then we would support them using our instructional assistants to provide that support to those teachers.
How do you do that? Is it by phone? Is it by Zoom? Is it?
Yeah. What we do is, well right now we have over 55. It's upwards of 55, closer to 60% of our households that have technology, and they know how to use it, of course. So now what we try to do is that we're focusing on the ones that we have not heard from that we feel that they either have technology at home and they haven't responded, or they don't have Wi-Fi or technology at home. Mm-hmm. But what we do is that we have to just make phone calls. What we've done is we've identified a lot of those families, and I have the instructional assistants in throughout the district make those phone calls. We just have to do that hard legwork to make those phone calls home to those families to see what we can do to help support those families. It's tough, but that's just the old-fashioned way that we have to do it. We have to do that legwork. We just have to do it.
I have an email from Walter, and I'm not sure I understand it. One is, he's saying, sure wish you would have some of those immigrants on the radio, and so do I, Walter, and that's another show for another day. Secondly, why not announce what languages are needed to help translate to help immigrants? I think we have done that. Angie Plummer, I was going to ask you, when you help settle a family in Central Ohio from wherever, how do you make the connections with the school district? What kind of priority is that, and how does that work?
Well, pre-COVID, that was a very hands-on, take them to the enrollment center, get the kids enrolled in school. connect them to the whole system, be a liaison. Mm-hmm. And so now, just like Michael said, it's the old-fashioned telephone way is how, you know, we're connecting with clients and finding out, trying to walk them through setting up their technology needs, that kind of thing.
And the emotional piece of this, Michael, again, with the parents. But then I'm also thinking about the young kids who maybe don't have the same kind of voice that an older child might. Is there a difference, in other words, between a younger elementary age school student versus, you know, one of the ones in high school? Are the issues different?
Yes, from an ESL standpoint, the issues are different. We know that elementary school students that come into us very new, of course, at the elementary level, they're learning kind of the same things, the vocabulary, the phonics, and things like that. So at the elementary level, when they're with us for a certain amount of time, they tend to catch on because, of course, they have time, and they're kind of learning the same thing as our American students in the classroom, okay? Uh-huh. But now where we run into a slight problem is that we get some students that come to us, newcomers to Columbus, to America, that they're older, that their education has been interrupted where they're in their home country, what we call a SLICE, or students with limited or interrupted education. So what we do is that that's where we tend to struggle just a little bit, because if we get a kid that comes in and he's already 15, 16 years old and has very limited access to schooling before he arrived here, that's a struggle all in itself. That's a different kind of struggle that we have within Columbus City Schools that we work hard on.
That's where they're coming here without literacy skills that can translate into another
exactly.
language. Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah, and that's where we struggle just a little bit, but what we do
I can't imagine you don't struggle a lot. I mean, it just sounds like the ultimate struggle. Plus, they're teenagers.
Yes. And you're absolutely right. And so our focus is on that, too, on making sure that we reach out to those kids in our newcomer program. That what we do is at Columbus Global Academy, we try to bring those students in to Columbus Global Academy, work on the language acquisition for a year or maybe even a little bit more, and then we move them out to their school or their home school where they still have ESL support there. But those kids that come in with limited or interrupted education, we try to work with those kids at our newcomer program up at Columbus Global Academy before we push them out into the general education setting.
Ugh, it sounds scary. Angie?
I will say our community is so fortunate to have a Global Academy. Not every city has that kind of focus, and the teachers there are dedicated and committed to those students. And you identified the group that's the hardest to serve. It's that teenager who missed so many, you know, opportunities for education.
Yeah.
And these schools take them as they get them and, you know, do the very best that they can. But it's you know, a tough road. When you're 4 and 5, you can come into school and learn a new language. But if you missed all those years and never had a math class, it's tough.
Mm-hmm. Because, of course, the studies say that it takes about, you know, anywhere from 5 to 7 and maybe even a little longer years to learn a language, of course, to be, you know, language acquisition enough to be able to function in the general education classroom here in America. So that studies say that. So we got our work cut out for us. But like Angela was saying, our teachers, they're great. Our principals are great, and we also get all the support we need from the district because they provide us with the support we need in order to make this happen. So we're in this together.
What kind of expectations are you setting for students right now with in the ESL realm during the pandemic, Michael Sane?
Yeah, what we're doing is that we're reaching out to those to those students, and what we do is we're providing the virtual settings or the platforms that we're using. What we do is that we just want to make connection, and we want to make sure that we provide what we call grace in this situation, that we want our teachers to reach out to these students, and if they're working through what the teachers are trying to provide, if they're trying and they're putting forth effort, we're going to be there right there with them, of course. So it's tough right now because a lot of our students, it's tough with that connection, making that connection with them to make sure that they have access to the technology and things in order to get on those platforms. But we're making sure that we don't hold anything against them. Of course, if they're reaching out to try to do the work that the teachers are providing, then that's what we're looking for. Just some continued work throughout the fourth quarter while this pandemic is, you know, we're in this situation to see that they're trying to work with what we're providing them. So we're just making sure that it's nothing that's being held against them because of this particular situation. Huh. So,
You know, I keep going back to the isolation in my mind. I mean, I'm just thinking about that. And I'm also thinking about the economics of all of this. And something as simple as having access to books is affected during this time. Right, Michael?
Yes. In this situation, of course, with an ESL student, you know, the books and things like that, it's a tough situation because, of course, a lot of our ESL students, especially the newcomers, mm-hmm. of course, we rely on that. It's not as much a technology that we rely on when they're in the classroom at Columbus Global Academy. It, of course, some computer things and some supports and resources that we use is on computer because, of course, you know, ESL students learn mm-hmm. by what they see. See, so, but a lot of that work is done by virtue of a textbook and whatnot. But the thing is, a lot of the textbooks and things that we have at Columbus Global Academy for the newcomers, of course, it's modified. See, so it makes it tough with the situation and the pandemic being like it is. It's tough for us to get that work, the actual physical work, mm-hmm. to those students. You know, so that's a piece that we're discussing now on how, you know, this all hit us. We're kind of building this plane as we go here and trying to contact those ones that, let's say, hey, I don't have access to technology. So, well, how are we going to get some information to those kids or get lessons to those kids? But then again, it's tough because, of course, with those newcomers, it's more than just putting the book in front of them and say, okay, here it is, go with it. You know what I mean? It takes a lot of hands-on, which they get at Columbus Global Academy. So that's a piece of the district that we're working on. But, you know, in the event that we have to lead into this next year. So those are conversations that we're having right now.
Yeah.
To kind of address those things if we have to do it. How do we handle those kids that are not able to technology-wise be on technology in order to, and understand how to get on, how to understand to, you know, for the teacher to help them modify those lessons. So we're working through some of those things.
Wow. Angie Plummer, are you hearing from people who are struggling with their kids and worried about their kids falling farther behind?
Yeah, I think we've heard from some mothers who were particularly depressed, you know, feeling inadequate, not able to get their kids up to speed. Hearing from kids who left all their stuff in their lockers, haven't been able to go back. And then it's all kids who are missing their sports teams and their friends,
mm-hmm.
And that teacher who was their support, and that's, you know, a challenge for everybody, new American or not.
Mm-hmm.
This technology issue and particularly transportation being a barrier. If you need to ride the bus to go downtown to pick up the Chromebook, and the bus routes have changed and no longer go past your house. You know, all those things are just layer upon layer of obstacle.
Michael Sain, we have just about a minute left. I wanted you to tell us about, is there any kind of consortium nationwide where people like you are gathering to share ideas and strategies?
Yes, Columbus City Schools and, of course, myself, we're part of the Council of Greater City Schools. And that's just a consortium of directors and schools all over the United States that we come together, and that's pretty much weekly. And we talk about these things, how are these things being handled in different areas, and we kind of brainstorm with each other, and we kind of get information from each other that we take back to our own district to use. So it's ideas that we come up with, and of course, at any one call, we're having 50, 60, 70 different districts on those calls. With the leaders of the consortium, and then we bring those ideas back and we use them together. So with each district, so we get information and ideas from each other to work on that. Yes, we do.
Hmm. Well, Michael Sain, thank you so much for your time today, and best wishes as you move ahead, you know, out of this school year and into the next. Take care.
Thank you. Appreciate it. Thank you for having me. Bye-bye.
Michael Sain is director of the Columbus Global Academy and director of ESL Support Services for Columbus City Schools. Also with us, Angie Plummer. Thanks to you for your time today. I really appreciate it.
Thanks, Dan. It's been a pleasure.
Angie Plummer, executive director at the Community Refugee and Immigration Services. That's it for now. Thank you so much for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. We'll be right back.